My name, I'm afraid to touch this thing. Delights beyond my imagination here. I'm Peg Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I've been sober since February the 4th, 1964, and for that I'm very grateful. No pressure for me up here today. I don't know how many friends I've got in this audience. I mean, every time I turned around, somebody was coming up. There are people here from that I saw get sober in Omaha who... Have you ever noticed how many people are from Nebraska? They don't live there anymore, except for people like me, who undoubtedly has brain damage. And my friends from Leslie and Jack... Leslie was also a native Omahan and does no longer live there. But I'm glad to be here. I'm glad for the weather. God, aren't we lucky people? I mean, could you imagine when you were sitting in the Trails End or whatever your bar that... The ones that I always liked to drink in were really dark, and they really smelled terrible. And you could get a whiff of them as you pass them by on the sidewalk, you know. And can you imagine when you were sitting in there, if you had turned to the person next to you and said, "You know, I'm just preparing myself for AA," and someday I'm going to go to a conference in Monterey, California, sober, and I'm going to be in one of the most beautiful pieces of real estate in the whole world, sober. But right now, I better have another drink because I'm still preparing myself. Did you ever think about what we would be or what would be going on with us if we really got what we deserved or anything? I mean, sitting in the Trails End, it sure for me sure wasn't to be here in Monterey, California. I mean, actually being asked to say something, you know. I'm always kind of astounded too, because I have no illusions about myself, you know. I used to, my ego keeps trying to tell me that I should have these illusions about myself, but I really don't. You know, I'm just an AA member, you know. I go to meetings and I have a sponsor and I can put two words together, you know. Sometimes my synapses aren't firing too well and I sound like a blithering idiot, you know, a lot of times. But did you ever think about, you know, what an awesome thing it is to actually be asked to come someplace again, you know? Come again? You know, it's like they already had you once and you didn't just make them want to throw up or anything, so they had you back. And when I was drinking, nobody wanted me to come again. They wanted me to stay away again. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. And I didn't want to have anything to do with me either. And see, that's the dilemma that I was in, was that I was sick of me. I wanted to gag on my own life. But I didn't know how to get out of it. It was a hideous situation. And here I am. Because I'm an alcoholic, because I'm a drunk, because I have stayed sober and I've put one foot in front of the other and gone to meetings and still have a sponsor and still do the deal. I don't know what makes people think after they've been sober for a certain length of time that they're exempt from doing the deal. You know, I didn't get unalcoholic all of a sudden or anything. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you've noticed this or anything, but the more sober that I have become, the further away from the last drink that I have gotten, sometimes I get pretty nutty, you know, and I'm still an alcoholic. Honest to gosh, do you think like other people? today? Do you think like other people? Do you? I mean, I'm a binge thinker. I get to thinking about something and I just think it and think it and think it. And I think, I'm not going to think about it anymore. And I just think about it even more. I just can't, it just drives me crazy. So I need meetings more now than I really did when I first got sober. Because, see, when I first got sober, I don't know what you were like, but my sobriety was pretty cheap. You know, I'd been drinking $2.80 pop-off vodka, you know, a quart a day, for as long as I could, for whenever I could get it. I didn't have any friends. I didn't have a job. My parents were just totally despaired. They just were just absolutely, they had no idea what to do with me. My brother and sister weren't speaking to me. They didn't even claim me. The dog died in the last 3 months of my drinking. I think he died of liver cancer. And I think, you know, I think I sort of breathed on him too much. He was my drinking companion. You know, he was the only one that'd stick around me. And then he died. And I got sober 3 months later. There might be some lesson in that. But I had no God. I had no integrity. I had no help. Had portal cirrhosis of the liver. I had very few brain cells left. I mean, I kind of patch life together now sometimes. But my sobriety was very, very cheap. It was inexpensive. I mean, if you'd offered for my life at that point, my life wasn't worth a whole lot. It was not worth a whole lot. And I went to a meeting every day, and I called my sponsor every day, and I stuck out my hand at meetings every day, and I picked up ashtrays. That's when we still smoked in meetings and stuff, and I picked up ashtrays, and I washed coffee cups, and I did everything I could because I didn't want to drink again. And I didn't have any better ideas. I didn't have, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with the best gift anyone could have ever been given. And I wish this gift to new people today. And I don't see it today like I saw it then. I don't know if I'm just getting old or what, but I don't see it like that. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a degree of desperation that was priceless. I would have done and did anything to stay sober. And I don't see that desperation in a lot of places that I go. People just today are just not, I sound like an old fool when I say stuff like this, but maybe that people don't seem to be as desperate as they were in the good old days, you know. But I came to AA with desperation. And it meant that I didn't, if I'd have had a single better idea, if I'd had one better idea about what to do with my life, I'd have done it and I'd have been dead. But I didn't have a single better idea. And so I just did what was there to do in front of me, to what I was told. You know, people get so prissy about people telling them, I'm not having a sponsor. I'm not having any dictator sponsor. You know, you're supposed to become free when you get in here, you know. And you know what it says in the book? It's freedom from self is what the big deal is here. Not necessarily freedom from doing the right thing, or it's freedom from my own self. And so it was a good thing I was desperate, because then I was willing to do what people suggested to me. And it wasn't, my sponsor was the beginning, but you know, there was Big Frank, and he was like 6'7". Everybody in the world terrified me. I don't know. I did not come into AA as a model of mental health. I was terrified of everybody. I was shaking all the time. I was a mess physically. I mean, I looked hideous. And I didn't know how to talk. You know, I would think about this. I'd get the hand right, you know. I'd try to copy people, you know. I'd kind of get the hand right to get ready to say something, you know, like this. And then I couldn't say anything. I couldn't think of what to say, you know. And I'd read this, like, cereal boxes and stuff, you know, and try to think of things to get for conversation because I couldn't follow a book, you know, cereal. You know, they like two or three page little paragraphs on the side of cereal box that gives you a fact about something, you know, and I'd say things like, lots of wheat grows in Minnesota. Whoa, God, you know. I mean, it sounds funny, but, I mean, they tested me when I was a kid, and I had, like, a really high IQ, but it just went through the holes or something in my brain, just out the other side. So I'd get the hands right, and then I'd have to think of something to say. And, you know, it was so hard to do two things. I could do one. You know what I'm saying? It was like, what do I do now? Or I could call on the phone. I don't know about you guys, but the phone terrified me. Because it was an instrument of communication. You had, when you picked it up and dialed it, you were supposed to say something to people on the other end. You know, they said, hello. And you're not supposed to hang up, you know, because you're terrified. But lots of times I would just hang up, you know. Or, like, call my sponsor. She made me call her every day. They made me call her every day. I'd pick up the phone and I'd dial it, you know. And I'd go, oh, it's you. Have you done this? It was desperate. I didn't know how to live. And it was not like I didn't start out life like that. I mean, I had sense and stuff, but I drank so much that I drank it all away. It's just like it just goes through you, you know, and kind of takes out a lot of cells or something when it does. And chemically, it really does do that. But it fried my brain, and it scorched my hair, and it dangled my ears, and it flattened my boobs, and it, you know, it puffed out my liver, and it, you know, it doughed up my face. You know, my face looked like big lumps of Pillsbury dough, you know, hanging on there with red veins running through it and stuff. And it gets into the, you know, if you drink the way I drank, and people in my life were always wanting to help me. I mean, even today, even like the federal government, they're always wanting to help us, you know. And what they really want to do is help us drink. You know, have you ever noticed how those studies always come out and it says, well, alcoholism is, you know, you might, they're trying to get us to moderately drink. And the thing that I always found amazing was I never, ever, 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 ever wanted to moderately drink. That's the fallacy of their argument, see? I didn't want to moderately drink. I wanted to get blasted. They don't understand that kind of thinking. You know, they think we should want to drink moderately. And I didn't want to drink moderately. But I drank, you know, when you drink the way I drank, about a quart a day, it does really bizarre things to you. And it does a lot of bizarre things to your hair, because your hair is a bunch of protein. It's like, if you ever really want to drive yourself crazy, lay down at night and think about protein. See, I told you I was a bench thinker. Get to thinking about how there's this protein lying around your head, you know, like this. And how this is the building block of life, you know. I may be crazy, but I sure have a good time. Anyway. When you drink a lot, it goes into your bloodstream, and it goes immediately, finds these pathways, protein pathways, and it goes into your hair. And now it's not, you know, it goes right straight into the shaft of your hair. And then your nails, girls, women, you know, your nails all break off and get wavy looking and stuff, and your skin itches and flakes off, and your hair dies. I mean, it just, you know, it's all got all this. Because when it goes in there like that, you know, this alcohol goes in, there's all these little neurons that talk to each other. And no, it's true. It's really true. Ask a doctor. You guys find a doctor. I was on the plane with a biologist today. I should have asked him. Anyway, this guy's just, and the alcohol goes into these synapses, and you got all these things, and they're like dinging each other like this, little arms going like that all the time, and it makes electricity, and then we think and we move and we drive our cars and stuff and blink and everything, you know, breathe in and out, and these things are, they're part of our bodies, and there's billions of them all over our body, and they tickle each other like this. And when you drink, the alcohol goes along these things. And see, these little things, there's a spark that jumps across this pathway. Okay? Trust me. There's a spark. Okay, so you drink. And these things don't like alcohol. Because the way we drink it, because it's really, really, you know, it's really... Anyway, it dingles these things, see? And they go like this. Eek! Eek! So... when the spark jumps across the pathway, it zaps the ends of these things. So you get fried. You're fried is what it comes down to. It's true. It's honestly God true. And you do that often enough, and you get brain damage. And you can't feel your toes and your fingers, and you can't remember where your car is and all this stuff. Well, it does the same thing to your hair. When this stuff gets... See, you knew... I knew I'd get back to my hair. Get back... my sister was trying... She wanted to help me. And my hair had looked like someone... my head looked like somebody had just, like, put shredded wheat all over it. You know? Big biscuits of shredded wheat. She said... You need to shape up. You know, you need to, let's do something with your hair. You know, let's get you shaped up. You know, because I was always trying to shape up. Remember, I mean, shape up. And I would, and when I'd have these days of shaping up, then I would try to put some makeup on, and I might even risk a bath, which was really brave in those days, because I just didn't bathe. I was afraid of water. I was afraid it would get too deep, you know. I put makeup on, and when you put makeup on, I use this little eyeliner thing. You know how women know about this. You guys know that. And it's really a very dangerous weapon if you're shaky. Because you can stab your ear. You can poke yourself in the eye. And then you get to going with the mascara brush. And my God, anybody can tell you that stuck one of those things in their eyes, it's bad. Well, when you're drinking... I mean, it's just like all over your face, especially if you forgot to take off the stuff you had on 3 weeks ago. So you end up looking like two big woolly spiders sat right on the middle of your face. Just right there. And you're wearing your best clothes, which is blue turtleneck sweater and gray stretch pants. And my sister says, we're going to frost your hair. So I got a big old thing of rum, poured a big thing of rum, sat down cross-legged on the floor, and she put this bathing cap on my head and cut holes in it, pulled big lobs of hair through it, and put this stuff on my hair. Well, you know, I told you about the things. And the, well, when you got as much alcohol in your system as I had, your whole head is drunk. You know, I mean, it's drunk. So when she put this stuff on, the chemical in my hair reacted to the chemical that she put on it. And when she took the cap off, I had, instead of these, it's supposed to be like silvery streaks, you know, for your, sort of go like this, and it glitters or something. Instead of that, I had bright orange blobs all over my head, which then broke off. So I had coin-sized bare spots in my head. So I had two spiders on my face, bare spots on my head, blue turtleneck sweater, gray stretch pants, and that's how I went to my first meeting. And this woman walked up to me, and she said, "My name is Jane, and I'll be your sponsor. You look new." So I was, you know, I really get a kick out of people today because they come and interview me to see if I'm a suitable sponsor or something. We never had the option of being interviewed. People came up to you and said, "You're mine." And that's what she did. And you know, isn't that funny? Because that was God's work, wasn't it? I mean, it was totally out of the blue. That was God's work. I had nothing to do with it. See, my problem is I think that I should have something to do with my life. I always think that. I think that today, that I should have something to do with my life. That I should be the prime mover and shaker in my life. And you know what I have experienced and found through the years? When I am the prime mover and shaker in my life, I move and I shake. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, God, I have all kinds of better ideas and it never turns out right. When I listen to my sponsor, when I listen to those people who are well-meaning towards me, when I listen to new people in the program, it doesn't matter where the message comes from. Sometimes I hear the message I can remember messages given to me by Margie and Cheryl. I remember those kids when they got sober. And believe me, were they a mess. I mean, oh! No worse than I was, however. But they gave me messages. People, it doesn't matter how long people have been sober if I'm teachable. If I think I know it all, nobody can tell me anything. I don't care if you've been sober 45 years. I'm not hearing you because I'm not listening to you. You know, I think I know it all. I think I'm not teachable. Nobody can tell me anything when I'm like that. But if I just get out of the middle of my own life, if I get out of my own way, if I quit standing when I stand and make shadows for myself. But when I do what I do every day, and there's a lady here in the audience who sent me, it was the oddest thing, the way I got this third step prayer in a little red frame that I keep on my desk. I start every day with the third step prayer. And some days when I'm, snapping my fingers and clicking and stuff, God, I offer myself to thee. I am full of it. And then some days I say, God, I offer myself to thee. I build with me and do with me. Oh, please. And that's the best day. Those are the best kind of days, is when I am that kind. So I have, I use that all the time. I use it all the time. When I stay out of my own way, I never can seem to remember that all the time, though. Isn't it weird? I just get to going and I take it all back. It's like my ego is like the phoenix that rises from the ashes of my defeat. It really is, and that's why I have to go to meetings all the time. And it's why I'm still in AA. What makes me think I'm exempt from that? What am I going to do, say, oh, ego, stop doing that? My ego doesn't listen to me. Just, you can feel it kind of burbling up, It's the set of the jaw and the way my back is and the reaction I have when somebody says something or criticizes me in some fashion. It's that gut reaction I have when somebody calls. Like somebody called in the middle of the night last night. Like 2:30. You guys, this is really exciting. This is exciting. AA is not bigger today. I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but AA is smaller today than it has been in recent years. And the reason for that is because treatment centers, a lot of them have gone out of business, and they are not pumping the people into Alcoholics Anonymous that they did. But the nifty thing is that we stand on the brink of one of the most exciting times in AA, because we're going to get to have people throw up on us all over again. We're going to get to have people pee in our cars. I got so excited. The other night in our meeting at Foxhall, we had a woman who was just blitzed. And I sat right next to her, just smelled her. It's been a long time since we had a real life job. We're standing on the threshold of that right now. We're starting to get real live people, real live bad drunks in here, unscathed by any recovery whatsoever. And that's exciting, isn't it? It's so exciting to me because I'm not knocking people coming out of treatment for, I got dried out and everything. You couldn't tell me anything at 6 months of sobriety. I was so arrogant and egocentric and stuff. And so everybody, it's the same thing. It's no big deal. But I am saying this is a different day. And they're over the country, and I don't know if Scott and Greg have noticed this, but when I travel around, there is this apathy in Alcoholics Anonymous today about there's just places where there's no enthusiasm. When you're talking to them or you're in a meeting or you're in a discussion meeting, it's almost like you're talking to a mural painted on the wall or something. They're all sitting there like this. They have no gratitude for the fact that they're alive, that their butts are in an AA meeting. And today I see that a lot because it was been easy for them. But it's not going to be so easy anymore. And that's why I'm so grateful for that desperation that I had, because it wasn't easy for me when I got sober. And it wasn't easy for those guys to help me because I was horrible. I was a real bad attitude person. After the first 6 months, 6 months of desperation, towards the end of that, I could feel that ego rise, and I didn't know that at the time. I just thought I was feeling better, And it was like, give me back my life. Thanks a lot, AA, but I'll take it from here. You understand what I'm saying? I could feel myself taking it. again. And you know, I go through periods of time like that now. Don't tell me you guys don't. You do too. Because you do. Because if you're a real alcoholic, you think you're growing new legs. Every once in a while, you get to think you're growing new legs. And I know for me, it's like, I've been going to 4 and 5 meetings a week for a long time, 32 years. What's wrong if I skip a night? Nothing. But then in 2 weeks, I might do it again. And then 3 weeks, I might do it again. And the scary thing about it is this, and you just watch in your groups, because this happens in our groups, and I've seen it happen time and time again. People disappear so slowly that we don't know they're gone till they're gone. We don't know they're gone till they're gone. And I don't want that to happen to me. My sobriety's too expensive. Look at what I've got. I'm in Monterey, California. Closed. And in... I was going to say in my right mind. But it is in my right mind. It doesn't mean it's the right mind. It's my right mind. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm trying to help people. I have friends. I have some money, a little money. I have a car. I have 2 ancient dogs. I have an ancient husband. I have a medium ancient kid. And I have a brand new grandson. Joe. Don't get me started on Joe. I mean, Joe. He's going to be a Nebraska Cornhusker. That's what he's going to be. Big. I got season tickets to Nebraska Cornhusker games. I mean, I'm a Big Red fan. I won't get started on that, but maybe I will. But all of those things are really because I'm sober. They're really because I'm sober. If I wasn't sober, I wouldn't have any of those things. None of them. So I am very grateful. And I want to transmit that gratitude. I want you guys to transmit your gratitude. It's not enough for me to do that. It's not enough for Scott or Greg or any of those people that you will see. Each one of us is like a tiny sun. A tiny sun. And if we radiate, the people around us will be affected by the light, won't they? If we do the deal, if we don't give up on the deal, if we continue to express our gratitude by having enthusiasm for that we have been really rescued from a hopeless state of mind and body, then the whole of Alcoholics Anonymous will be affected. And we can go out there and pick up people who are going to pee in our cars and take them to meetings and sit next to them and sniff them and get them to the next meeting and have them call you with these monumentally stupid problems that just drive you, you know, out of your tree. They're so stupid until you remember that you had a problem similar to that. Possibly as little as 2 weeks prior to this. And that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one person. Please, I'm not trying to be controversial here. So it's just my observation. We can read about this. The big book is wonderful. I wouldn't trade it for anything. But it's a part. It's a part of recovery. There are the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are also a part. There are the traditions, which, if you have a bad marriage, try working those babies in it. That's a part of our recovery. The meetings are a part. But what is essential? There are two things, in my view, that are essential. And that is for me to turn my own self over to God, as I understand it, every day, and then tell somebody I have done so. And by helping them to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, do what is the only thing that I have been given as a gift to do that other people have not been given that are out there. And that is the ability to help another alcoholic. It's the only thing I have that makes me unique and makes you unique, is that we can help each other. And that is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you something else. This is not like a lottery. You know, there's tons of lotteries now. State lotteries, big lotteries, little lotteries, multi-million dollar lotteries, and all of them, you buy a ticket. You get a ticket to these lotteries. And there's usually a little place where you fill in your name and address, your phone number and stuff. On the back of the ticket, it says, need not be present to win. AA's not like that. This is not a lottery. We must be present to win. And in order to be present, it doesn't mean just coming to the meetings, does it? It doesn't mean sitting there like a rutabaga on your chair till you grow roots out through the vinyl. It means getting up and doing what I, you know, for me, I have to do what I did in the beginning. What makes me think today that I shouldn't do what I did in the beginning? What makes me think I'm exempt from doing the little things in AA? Like shaking people's hands and taking coffee cups out and putting away my chair in somebody else's and helping a newcomer and answering the phone in the middle of the night. What makes me think I'm exempt? What? Am I some kind of AA big shot or something that I don't have to, if I finish paying my dues? I don't think so. Because every day I get another gift. Every day somebody else comes along and gives me another gift. And let me tell you this. Oh, it's just, sometimes my head is just going so fast I can't. I guess my biggest gift since I've been, when I was sober 15 years, I thought this was about as good as it was going to get. This is as good as it's going to get. My life was so good. I was married. I have a good marriage. I have a great husband. He's my AA running buddy. I had made amends to my parents, people I had hurt tremendously. I see my parents every week. I go up and have tea with them every week. My dad's 86. My mom's 84. I'm going home early on Sunday so I can, her birthday, it's her birthday, and I want to, you know, it's her 85th birthday, and I'm going to be there at her birthday. I mean, she was there when I was got sober. She's the one that kicked me in the butt to get me to a meeting and get me dried out and that kind of thing. It's the damn least I can do to be there for her at when she's 85 years old. And I do that, you know, and I love those people. Those people are my heroes. They have been well-meaning towards me all of my life, and they are my heroes. And I damaged those people so severely. Let me tell you something else. I really think if I hadn't made amends to them and to other people, that I would not still be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that people leave because they have left an amend unmade or a secret unshared. In all of the years that I have sponsored people, those are the two reasons fundamentally that people leave. Now, they say other things. They use other excuses. I don't like that group anymore. You know, they're too rigid. Oh, I don't like her. She's taking my inventory all the time, you know. I don't like him. He's always droning on and on and on. And doesn't everybody have one of those in the meeting?
I learned a great secret from an old guy named Don Kane in my early days. He used to sit in meetings and he would have his hands like this. And I said, "Don, are you meditating?" He said, "No, I'm sleeping." But he said, "If anybody asks, just tell them I'm meditating." But he said, if you did like this, then when people looked at you, it really does help you to concentrate, and you're thinking about that, then people will think you're getting the message, and you may be just getting a nap, which was a great thing for me, because there's some guy that's droning on and on, I can just have a little nap, little secret of a old-timer. It doesn't happen very often, but the point is that there are people like that in every group, and if we want to leave, we can leave because we'll have an excuse to. But I made my amends to my folks, and I have done all of those things, and I am so grateful. But if there is, and because when the actions of the steps, for me anyway, cleaned out that pipeline that between me and whatever power I was to find. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know about you, but I had no concept of a power greater than. Just none. I mean, I couldn't even think, much less judge or reason or feel. And to me, that gift that I have been given of spirit, of being able to clear out that pipeline and feel that gift from God, feel the presence, is a gift I just hope it keeps going, because at 15 years I thought I had it all. If I had known how much I was going to grow from the time I was 15 years sober to today at 32 years sober, I would have never believed it. The best is yet to come, friends. I can't be so unique. I am not unique. I'm just a broad from Nebraska. I mean, what am I? I mean, I am not unique. If I have grown more since I was sober 15 years to the present day, you will too. And the way that I have grown is in that feeling inside of me that God is good, that He's on my side, that I have a power that I can live by. And I'm not religious. It isn't something, I'm not religious. I'm an AA member. My spirituality comes to me. I see things, spirituality, through things that happen to me every day. God sends me little messages and power and stuff, do things that happen every day. He makes me grateful for things just by looking at some of the animals that are in my neighborhood. I remember thinking what a nifty trick it was for God. I was sitting at Kmart, in the Kmart parking lot, and you know how in the summertime Kmart has that garden section? It's like a portable garden section, at least it is in Nebraska, because obviously they ain't not going to put anything out. It was 8 below yesterday. They're not going to have trees sitting out in the parking lot, So they bring this little portable garden thing, and they have a little wire fence that goes around it, and they have some little bird baths and bushes and trees that you can go in and buy. And there was this there was this tree that was for sale, and it was a pretty big tree, like about a 15-foot tree. And this bird had built a nest in this portable tree. And here was the nest, and here were all these people walking around looking at this bird, and I was sitting there waiting for somebody to come out of Kmart, and the other bird, the daddy bird, I guess, or whoever, I guess the birds, both of them feed the babies. And the babies were in the nest. They were all perked up, you know, like that. And the parents were up on the roof at Kmart. And they're, you know, and they go get worms and bugs and stuff. And they feed these babies in the portable tree. And I thought, that's an alcoholic robin. He's built his nest on sand. You know, because they're going to carry this tree off. And his babies are growing up in urban blight. You know, I mean, and the bugs he's catching are like Kmart bugs, you know, which may be pretty bad, I don't know. And so I got to thinking about that, so I went to the guy at the garden center. And I said, you got a bunch of baby birds in that tree. He said, I know. I said, you can't sell that tree. He said, why not? I said, because those babies will die. What? I mean, the parents aren't going to follow that tree to Millard, for God's sake. You know, what are you going to do? And I had about a 20-minute conversation with him about this aberrant bird, you know. And all through this, I really felt... I felt like I was supposed to do something with about this thing. Well, I got this guy so upset that the next day I went back and there was a sign they had stuck in the tree that said, not for sale. So, see, God sent me that bird. And a bunch of AAs got together. Of course, I went and told about this alcoholic robin. And so when they were closing up shop at the end, when they get rid of all their stuff, a bunch of AAs went and got the tree. We went and got the tree. We bought the tree and put it over in Scott Barnard's yard. So now we, and, you know, and we were careful to drive along and watch him for these. Well, the babies had long gone by then, but we took the tree and it's got its little nest up there and everything. You know, I would have never thought about something like that. I didn't. You know what it says in the book? Selfishness, self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our problem. Not was. Got it? Is. Today. And the miracle of this thing that touches every one of us when we let it is that I can, for a short while, be unselfish enough to do something about a bird. So I see God through things like that. I feel Him through things like that. See, I spent years and hundreds of thousands of dollars and years and years and years of my life and gallons and gallons and gallons of beer and pop-off vodka not to feel anything. Not to feel anything. Because I think my alcoholism is the variety in which I just felt everything just way, way too much. Just way too much. Just way too much. And after I got sober, you know, people would say, gosh, I sure like your hair that way. And I'd say, what's the matter? Didn't you like it the other way? And I was so pleasant, you know. I got mad at my sponsor and sulked around for about 3 or 4 days. I don't even remember what it was about. She said, what are you sulking about? And I said, I'm not sulking. She said, yeah, you are. You're mad at me. What are you mad at me for? So you hurt my feelings. She said, I hurt your feelings. I said, yeah, and I'm sensitive. She said, you're not sensitive, you're a touchy bitch. I didn't say that word. She said that word. But I was, and I am, from time to time. I still am. See, the thing about it is that my character defects, your character defects, the difference between our character defects and the character defects of people like my sister, Suzanne, who is not an alcoholic. My sister, her character defects probably will not kill her. But mine will. Because sooner or later, left to my own devices, without AA, without God, I will drink again. Because that is the nature of the alcoholic. It is my nature to drink. It blotted everything out, it made everything okay, and I used it and abused it, and I really think I did it like you guys did it, and that was we gave it everything we had. I gave it everything I had. And now I want AA. I want to do AA the same way. I want to give it everything I have. I don't want to go to my maker. I don't want to go to heaven or go to hell or wherever I'm going or go to a meeting. I think I'm going to a meeting. That's my version of heaven, is be a newcomer at a meeting. When I go to my meeting, I don't want to have to say I gave it a half shot. I want to say I gave it everything I've got. I think it's the least I can do. So this developing spirituality, this feeling of being all right, this wholeness of spirit comes to me in funny ways. And you know, sometimes I don't want to make it sound like I'm really just like pie in the sky happy all the time. I'm not. You know, a good friend of mine, Jim B. from San Jose, I want you guys to say a prayer for him because his leukemia is back and he's sick. And this is one of, you may like Jim and you may not like Jim. Jim is one of these people in AA who is, he's good, by his very nature, he's going to be controversial. God bless him. You know, I like people who stick their heads above the crowd and get shot at all the time. Because that's, you know, because that's the way I am. You know, I'm always getting shot at it some way or another. But he needs your prayers. And Jim Shaw. Is dying. And he needs your prayers. You know, he's the happiest one of all of us, you know, because he's playing golf. We're all mourning already. But he's sick. And these people are my heroes. You know, they're people I've grown up with in AA. So I'm not happy all the time. So sometimes things make me sad. I'm human. You know, I hate working. I hate working, and we just built this huge 8,200 square foot building, which my husband and I own. And I have to work there. I don't like working. I mean, it's like I always go to my office and I sit down at my desk and I think, somebody's going to find out that there's no grown-up in here. I'm still inadequate. I still feel puny, you know, spiritually puny sometimes. You want to get on an airplane and go to Australia or something. You know, I'm frail. I'm human. I suffer from all those frailties that other human beings do, but every once in a while, something will happen that just puts it right back into me again. Just because I keep doing the same things. Keep doing things over and over again. Keep doing the deal. Going to my meetings. Being present to win. Calling my sponsor, 571-8306. That's your phone number. If you don't know your sponsor's phone number, she isn't your sponsor. Because you're not using it enough. We were in South Carolina not too long ago. And they had, I'm going to tell you about three stories and then we're out of here. I know you're, this has been a very strange talk. I know you think, gee, I'm used to having drunk a logs and people got sober, and then back in Fargo, I was slipped off a bar stool, had a spiritual awakening, and there I came to A&A. Well, that's not the way I do it. I can't concentrate long enough to do that, so. I was speaking in South Carolina. I love the ocean. I came in over the bay in the airplane today, and you just follow the coast. You know, you go out over San Francisco Bay, and you just follow Highway 1 right down the coast. And I was watching the waves and the beautiful azure color and the cliffs and the green. See, it's real cold in Nebraska. It's like, you know, 8 below this morning. And there's nothing green. If it is, it's painted. And I was thinking to myself how I love the ocean, because you know when you go down and stand next to the ocean and you've got a problem, it pales into absolute insignificance next to that power and that beauty. And I go to the ocean every year, to North Carolina, to a little place called Duck, and I sit down by the ocean for a week with all the people from my family that I love, my mom and my sister and their kids and my kids. My dad won't come because we all talk too much, he says. And there's a healing, restorative thing to me to be there at the beach, to sit there on the beach. It's one of my very favorite places to be. And we were being asked to dinner. We went to dinner at this place called Sea Captain's House. Well, I had just gotten there, and I jumped out of the car. It was dark, and I ran down to the seawall. And they were doing some construction behind this restaurant. And there was a big, bright light, something like that locomotive light that's right there in front of me there, that was shining out to sea. And at night, when it's dark, the phosphorus in the waves, you can see the phosphorus. You know how it looks greenish white? And you could see the phosphorus coming in. But there was a path that this light made, just straight out. It's like the moon, only very bright. And in the path of this light were thousands and thousands and thousands of seagulls. Thousands. And they weren't outside. They were just right there in that light. And I was amazed. I mean, I was just stunned by, I'd never seen anything like this. They didn't seem to be doing anything, you know. I mean, they were just like bobbing around and visiting and stuff. But they didn't work, you know. So when I went into the restaurant, you know, I always want to appear, I'm such a dichotomy, you know. I don't want to appear to be gushy, although I am. I want to be tough, you know, kind of cool. So I said to the woman, "What's with the birds?" No. And she said, "We don't know, they just came here, but we think it's the light." And I thought about that. And of course it's the light. What are we doing here? What are we doing here? Isn't it the light? Of course it's the light. It's the light of reason. It's God's light. It's the light that shines on our character defect. It's the light of one alcoholic touching another alcoholic. It's the light of recovery. We're safe in the light. And those old birds knew they were safe in the light. So they just stay there. And, you know, I went back to Myrtle Beach a couple years later, went out there, same damn birds. Not the same ones. I'm sure there were
other ones, but
they were still there. And there was something so constant about it, and we were late. I was going out there with some friends, and they turned off the light at like 11 o'clock or something. And the birds were kind of confused, you know, for a minute. And I thought about that. I thought, what if they turned off the light here? I don't want that to happen. And so I want to maintain my gratitude. I want to maintain my enthusiasm for being given the greatest gift I've ever been given because of sheer desperation. And I'll never be able to pay it back. Not as long as I live. A couple of years ago, I saw God in those birds. You know, seagulls are kind of crappy birds. You know, they're not there. You know, they're sort of dumb. They get fishing lines stuck in their beaks all the time, you know, and it grows. But they were God's messenger, see? He sends me birds. You know, He sends me birds. Alcoholic robin. I was really scared one time in San Jose, and this bird crapped on me, you know, and I got unscared, you know, because this bird crapped on me. Got really character defects, came to the fork, flying in an airplane between, I was supposed to go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Bad, bad storm, and I'm praying, I'm clutching my medallion and telling God I'll cook dinner every night. And I'll be good, you know, if they just, you know, get me down out of this horrible storm. And I hear some paper crinkling behind me. I turn around, look, and there's this woman, and she's pulling a bottle of Smirnoff vodka out of this paper bag, and she takes the lid off and takes a big slug, and I felt better. You know, God sent me that woman. He sends me these funny little messages that I'm supposed to interpret. See, and if I'm in spit spiritual condition, if I'm fit spiritual condition, I can see them. But if I've got gauze over my eyes, if I'm in the bondage of self, if I'm like Miss Piggy, you know, I'm going, wah, 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 Miss Piggy, you know, I'm a Miss Piggy. I can't see them. They're just a bunch of dumb birds and a stupid woman on an airplane. You know, I can't see them when I'm not in fit spiritual condition. So I want to try to stay that way because I, you know, that they're striking these things that He sends me. And my husband and I walk our dogs every day. And we walk, and believe me, it is a labor of love, like a morning today, because we walk them every day. And we walked them this morning. It was cold. It's cold this morning. I'm sweating here. I mean, it's hot here. It's, you know, I said 8 below. It was about 35 below with the windshield. We're all bundled up, you know, we got two dogs and they're old and Cuckoo's deaf, and I mean it's just like this was about 2 or 3 years ago, and we were doing the same thing. Only Dick was gone and I was walking the dogs by myself. I feed a family of foxes and I take this leftover dog food and some steaks sometimes, some not-so-leftover dog food, and some hot dogs, and Chinese food is their favorite. Take that down there, and I just do dogs, and Charlie's on a leash, and Cuckoo's deaf, so who cares, you know, and usually, I'll dump the food down at the foot of this tree, And usually you get back about, like, about a half a block away, and then the foxes come up and they start eating food. And Dick got me a pair of binoculars for Christmas so I could bring them out and look at my foxes, you know, and see how they're doing, you know, and this kind of thing. And in the spring we see the kits, and they play and throw stuff up in the air and learn how to pounce. It's great. It's a wonderful, wonderful lesson of nature. It's just, I just love my foxes. And this particular, but they're shy, you know. They stay pretty much, you know, they're scared, and they should be. They're wild animals. So I dump the food down, and I mean, I am bundled up to my ears, just like this. And I had these little two chunks of ice right here in my nose, and trying to breathe around them, and I have my scarf up and everything, and Charlie's on the leash, and Cooper's in, all bundled up. And so I put the food down, and I turn, and I always say the same thing. I say, "Here's your breakfast, foxies." Isn't that dorky? It's really dorky. And I turned around, and I took about three steps, and I felt something. I felt something. Now, that's a miracle in itself, because I spent years trying not to be intuitive, trying not to feel anything, trying not to let the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune hurt me, injure me. I felt something. And I glanced over my shoulder, and as near to me as Diane is, sat the fox. And he was looking right at me, right in the eyes. And as I watched, he very slowly sat down. And then one paw at a time, never taking his eyes off me, he laid down. And it's not sad, it's beautiful. Because I think, see, I can think anything I want to when I'm having one of these experiences. It's my experience, you know. Because Dick teases me about it, you know, because when he... I'll put it down, you know, and if he happens to be on the other side, he'll go, "Peggy, it's the foxy." But I think he was saying thank you. I think he was telling me thank you for all the times I've put food down, for all the winters that I've gone down there and dumped out food for him and his babies. I think he was saying thank you. And see, God lets me see things like that. Because of people like you. And because of a God of my own understanding, and because of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a sponsor who cares dearly for me, I am able to feel and be and love and appreciate and be grateful. Thank you.